The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning, Glory America. Bones Roar High, Canada. Hugh Hewitt live inside the Beltway on this Wednesday, August the 18th in the year of our Lord, 2021. Grim news continues to flow in from Afghanistan. Let me begin, however, with Haiti, where the death toll has soared above 2,000. Hundreds, maybe thousands missing, many trapped, and now flooding from torrential downpours from a tropical storm. It is a dire situation. Last night, SRN's own Tom Tratup caught up with Arve Joseph to ask what was going on.
I know America always help out whenever they can. We're in a situation where we need it more than ever now. We're in a situation that was bad. It just got worse. I encourage people who are giving, especially to Food for the Poor, I encourage them to help in any way that they can so that we can help the people here. We've lost enough human lives. We should try as much as we can to save what we have left.
We have to save people in Kabul. We also have to save people in Haiti. You can't do much about Afghanistan as an individual right now, but you and me and the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt and I are doing this, can contribute to the Help Haiti campaign. The banner is at the top of HughHewitt.com. The phone number is 855-359-HOPE, 855-359-HOPE. The B-roll you see if you're watching on YouTube or on the universe is taken overnight as Haiti continues just to be a desperate situation. People trapped in Afghanistan, people trapped in Haiti, people trapped anywhere have to rely on people of goodwill everywhere to help them. Now to the news from Afghanistan. It is very, very grim as thousands are at the airport. 1,000 got out last night, but the Taliban have consolidated control around the airport and they are refusing to let people in. The headline in the New York Post this morning, shot dead, Taliban kill woman for not wearing burqa in public after vowing to honor women's rights. The Washington Post writes, withdrawal from Afghanistan forces allies and adversaries to reconsider America's global role. The Times of Israel Center article on the landing page recounts how every ally of America has been injured by the Biden catastrophe. And its title, with U.S. credibility gashed by Kabul fiasco, Israel may be bruised by association. Its analysis headline, it's not Saigon, it's much worse. This is by their principal diplomatic correspondent, Lazar Berman. Michael Oren writes the same thing. The vice president, former vice president of the United States, Michael Pence, took to the Wall Street Journal last night to excoriate people who say that the United States would have allowed this to happen had Donald Trump been reelected. We know that's not true. Mike Pompeo went on Fox with Trace Gallagher and made the same point, cut number 11.
Well, three things. The most important of which is we had a strategic understanding. They knew the risk if they pulled the stunt that they pulled these 96 hours, what that would mean for them. We told them we knew where they live. We knew where their community was. So the first thing we do was we had established American strength, American vigilance, and American power would be brought to bear. So that the most important thing we would have done differently is we would have demonstrated our resolve to protect and secure Americans and get our people out. Second, we had a understanding about how we were going to execute the sequence. That includes, importantly, President Trump making abundantly clear to all of us, we were going to get all of our equipment out, every stitch. Mm. And so we had begun to develop the plans to get that equipment out as well. And we would have never, lastly, we would have never begun to withdraw our military with so many American civilians still on the ground. Those are the folks that work for me, Trace. These are American diplomats and contractors who the Secretary of State has responsibility for. We knew that we would need a military force on the ground capable of making sure that we could get them to the airport and get them where they needed to be. We had thought through these risks, and we were prepared to maintain our deterrence posture, that is, the capacity to inflict costs, while we were delivering on President's objective to get our kids home.
David Petraeus, former commander-in-chief in Afghanistan, appeared on Fox with Bill Hemmer and said this, cut 15.
This administration has overturned innumerable policy decisions by the previous administration, the withdrawal from the WHO, from the Iran nuclear accord. You can name many more. And I don't know why it felt that it was in a straitjacket in this particular case. The fact is, I think that there were alternatives as we look at what is clearly a heartbreaking, tragic, I don't know how you can describe it as anything other than disastrous outcome in this case. And certainly there's a lot of blame to go around. I thought it was a bit uncharitable to cast quite as much, particularly on Afghan soldiers who until now, certainly a mixed bag, especially with the police, but the Afghan soldiers and especially the Special Operations Forces and their Air Force fought very, very hard over the years. Our concerns over those years and oftentimes were that they were taking such high casualties that they could not sustain that and maintain their end strength. And let's keep in mind that we have not lost a single soldier in battle since February 2020. So was there a sustainable, measured in the expenditure of our blood and treasure, sustained commitment that might have been made, maintained? I think that that was an alternative. Did we apparently underestimate what a number of us actually pointed out, and that is that there's going to be an enormous psychological blow, first with the announcement to withdraw, then with the actual withdrawal, because I think there are many in Afghanistan and probably in the United States who thought we'd look into the abyss and then draw back at the last moment, as we did before, including with the Trump administration. And then, of course, something that's somewhat overlooked was the withdrawal of some 18,000 contractors who maintained the U.S.-provided helicopter and planes that were the key to getting those great Afghan special operators and close air support to Afghan forces that were fighting at that point all around the country, simultaneous attacks by the Taliban in a whole host of different locations in a very, very vast mountainous country with limited road infrastructure. And frankly, once Afghan soldiers or any soldiers fight for a couple of days, as they did at the outset, and then realize that nobody has their back, there's nobody coming to the rescue, they are going to figure out that they either have to flee or they have to cut a deal and surrender. And that is exactly what many of the Afghan forces and local leaders did when they realized that there was no one coming to the rescue because the Afghan Air Force readiness had eroded so substantially. So that's, I think, the perspective. But let's get past all of that, if we could, Bill and Dana, and let's actually focus on what is most important now. This might be termed, I think, a Dunkirk moment, and we are responsible for a good bit of this, if not all of it, frankly. And we need to do everything humanly possible to get all of our American citizens out of Afghanistan, and also to get those in particular who qualify for the special immigrant visa and their family members who served 2 years on the ground as battlefield interpreters for our soldiers alongside our men and women in uniform. We have got to get them out of there as well. It's something that we failed to do really over the course of three administrations now. And we see what we can do when we get serious about it. You can put 600 people on a C-17 and fly them out of there if you have to. Remember, they could take two M1 tanks on a C-17. So that could actually lift that. That's not the safest way. And certainly they didn't have their restraining straps on in their seats. But this shows, I think, the humanitarian compassion of our men and women in uniform. And so we need to delegate to key people on the ground, military, State Department, Department of Homeland Security, which is, of course, in the visa and so forth process, allow them to make decisions. These are going to be wrenching decisions. It's literally about who goes, who gets on an aircraft, and who has to stay. And the Taliban are going door to door already. I've gotten emails from individuals hiding in basements and so forth. Mm-hmm. We are going to have to talk with the Taliban and talk tough with the Taliban. They don't want to get into a fight with us right now, I don't think. They have achieved what they sought. So why would they invite the United States military might on them at a moment when all they need to do is sit in the presidential palace and issue social media and video dispatches.
President Donald Trump on with Sean Hannity last night, cut 29.
It's a great thing that we're getting out, but nobody has ever handled a withdrawal worse than Joe Biden. This is the greatest embarrassment, I believe, in the history of our country.
He's not wrong. But most important of all, it is a Dunkirk moment, as David Petraeus said. It is time to get everybody out, to fill the airplanes until they stop. The Taliban have surrounded the airport now. We have to make it clear that the 15,000 Americans, our allies and our Afghan partners, have safe passage to the airport and out, or we have to reengage the Taliban. And I hope that they are beginning to draw up plans to do just that. There are some provinces in Afghanistan that have not fallen. I'll try and get more details on that. Bill Roggio of the Forever of the he's been at it longer than anybody. I am waiting for his guidance on whether or not these are legit provinces that are accessible by American air power. We'll find out. Stay tuned, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway live on this Wednesday, joined by Leland Bittert. He is the anchor for News Nation Now. He has got substantial experience with Afghanistan. Good morning, Leland. How are you?
Hugh, good morning to you.
Can you tell our audience your experience with Afghanistan?
Sure. So I spent 4 years in the Middle East for Fox News and covered everything from Egypt and Libya through the Middle East, a couple of wars in Israel, Ukraine, Syria, Turkey. And then obviously during that time, I spent a lot of time covering Afghanistan. In 2010 to 2014, there wasn't much going on there. So we didn't go out and embed with U.S. troops or anything like that, but covered a lot, especially in terms of the transition of power and a number of the negotiations the Obama administration went through.
So you're a credentialed foreign correspondent, Leland, and I want to dial in on the 15,000 Americans stranded in Kabul and throughout the country. What would you be doing right now if in any of these foreign deployments the United States had bugged out without notice and left you catastrophically high and dry? What would you actually do?
Well, it depends on where you are in Afghanistan, because the Taliban controls everything minus a couple of hundred yards around the airport. And what we're hearing so much from Afghanistan right now is that it's all well and good that the U.S. controls the airport, but a lot of the planes are leaving half full or a third full because people can't get into Kabul and then into the airport. And you think about Afghanistan being the size of Texas. So, yes, if you were at one of the foreign news bureaus inside Kabul and you were able to get the airport, you get to the airport and you get out. And I know that there's a number of other reporters and everything who believe that they have ways to get to the airport and get out and or reporting from inside the perimeter, if you will, but still able to report. If you're in the countryside of Afghanistan and one of these 15,000 Americans who's out there, whether you are a missionary or a contractor or whatever you were, you are really in harm's way. And effectively, the only thing protecting those 6,000 American soldiers on the ground in Kabul and the 15,000 Americans around Afghanistan is the goodwill of the Taliban. And those are some lousy people to have to rely on.
So, Leland, I'm trying to get to people to focus on. If you were Leland Bittert in Kandahar and you were overwhelmed, say you retreated to a village midway, you've got a cell phone charged. Would you make the decision just to drive to the airport? I mean, just to get into whatever car you could get and get as close to the airport and start walking? Or would you shelter in place? The United States government has given no one any guidance.
Well, even worse, Hugh, the United States government sent out a message, I think it was yesterday, last night, overnight, so today in Kabul, saying we're ready to evacuate you, come to the airport. And then in big, bold letters, it says the United States government cannot guarantee your security during your trip to the airport, effectively telling all these Americans, you're on your own, good luck. To answer your question specifically, it really so much depends on where you're at, exactly who you're with, what you view as your security situation. Who is controlling the roads specifically on your way from Kandahar to Kabul, who your fixers are. It's a much more delicate situation. The one thing I can assure you, though, is that if I was in Afghanistan right now, I would be trying really, 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 really hard to be getting out. It reminds me of when I was in Libya and we had Gaddafi's forces pushing us back towards the border with Egypt unrelentingly. And there was just nothing you could do. You just had to leave because you knew that being captured was much more dangerous than the threat of moving.
Now, Leland Bittert, I don't believe that I've seen much analysis on air. I didn't get to watch News Nation Now last night about the potential hostage situations that far exceed what we endured in Iran in 1979 and 80. With 15,000 Americans, the Taliban is not actually a command and control model. it's a series of tribes, and the Hazari, there are minorities that will be persecuted. There are Haqqani gangs that will take advantage of Americans. There are aid workers who are in the middle of nowhere. Does the United does President Biden evidence any knowledge of the complexity of this situation?
Evidence any knowledge? No. Wish you'd watched last night. We have Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, who is one of the founding officers of Delta Force, on to talk about just this issue of how do the 6,000 U.S. troops at the airport protect the 15,000 Americans throughout the rest of the country. And he said they don't. And I asked this very question that you brought up. I said, how worried are you about a Iran-style hostage crisis? Because all you need is one gang to take matters into their own hands and grab a couple of Americans, and you got a real ball game all of a sudden. And he said he was very, very worried. And certainly that would be the nightmare scenario for the Biden administration, because right now they're relying only on the goodwill of the Taliban for things not to go pear-shaped. Toss out another scenario for you. A lot of these Taliban fighters are hardened terrorists, and we know that because they've all been let out of jail by the Taliban as it moved across Afghanistan. Look, you have an RPG and a C-17 that have an unfortunate meeting on approach, and suddenly you've got 500 dead Americans very quickly. And that Taliban fighter or ISIS terrorist or whoever he is has now really kicked things off. And the United States military there sitting on the airfield are like sitting ducks. They only have two choices. One is to leave and the other is to fight. And Americans, at least by choice, American military soldiers and airmen don't really leave. So you've got a pretty big fight on your hands. And you can just imagine how quickly this could spiral out of control.
Now, I know, and I respect General Boykin quite a lot. Did you discuss with him, have you discussed with anyone, if American military is at this point planning to expand the presence, in other words, to reengage the Taliban, to fight? It seems to me an inevitable planning contingency they've got to be mapping out.
You'd certainly think they are. If you talk to the Pentagon on the record, they tell you that we're here to follow the orders of the commander-in-chief. And so far, the plan is to leave on August 31st. So there's not any telegraphing of that. But at the same time, they're saying we're ready to defend ourselves, and any attack on U.S. forces are going to be met with overwhelming force. So if you're going to put 6,000 Americans in harm's way, God, you think that you have a quick reaction force to come to help protect them and then to reinforce them if that begins. But it doesn't really seem like the Biden administration has absolutely any appetite to reengage the Taliban and wants nothing more than for this thing to just be over, even if that means leaving a lot of those Afghans behind, because at some point the Taliban says, your time's up and we control the area around the airport and nobody's getting in. So good luck.
General Leland, last question. I'm sure Jimmy Carter wanted the Iranian hostage crisis to be over. As long as there are Americans in Afghanistan, it won't be over. How long do you expect this will lead News Nation Now every night? Because while Americans are in harm's way, the American people focus like a laser on the president whose incompetence put them there.
Well, it's going to last a number of days longer than the Biden administration would like it to last. And to your point, it's going to lead until the Americans are gone and Americans are out of harm's way, because that's the standard the administration set. As long as you've got 6,000 American service members surrounded by the Taliban, that's going to be a problem for the administration. And I think you hit the nail on the head of, as long as there are Americans that are waiting to get out, it's going to be difficult. The U.S. military says they can evacuate 9,000 U.S. troops at a time, U.S. Citizens a day. Okay, fine, but they all got to get to the airport. And so far, that's not happening. So to answer your question, sadly enough, it seems as though that the answer is really in the hands of the Taliban.
I think you're right. Leland Vittert, what time is your show on? Because I want to watch it tonight, or at least tape it.
7 Central, 8 Eastern. If you've got YouTube TV or Hulu, just type in Leland, and it'll pop up. And then obviously your cable provider as well.
Leland Vittert, News Nation Now anchor, thank you for joining me. I also want to remind everyone in America that Haiti is in a terribly catastrophic state this morning. And Salem Radio Network is sponsoring and is sponsored by the Food for the Poor agency that is working there to deliver food around the clock. Help Haiti banner is at HughHewitt.com. Please be as generous as you can. Every summer I appeal to you for funds on behalf of Food for the Poor, but this is different. The 7.2 earthquake have crushed thousands of Haitians. Many, many relief agencies are absolutely not functioning at all. Food for the Poor is. You can get your donations into the reality of relief in Haiti by going to HughHewitt.com and donating as much as you can, or by calling 855-359-4673. Lots of people are distressed over Afghans, over Americans, over everyone in the world. You can help these people in Haiti because you can trust Food for the Poor. 855-359-4673, 855-359-HOPE, or go to HughHewitt.com and hit the banner Help Haiti, which you see on your screen if you're watching on the Salem News Channel. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway, talking with Congressman Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin. He is, of course, a member of the Armed Services Committee. Normally, we have a little jocular exchange, but this is too dark of a week. Congressman Gallagher, first, just an open field, your assessment of the last 96 hours.
Well, it's been a complete fiasco, and I do think at some point after we have hopefully rescued our people, there will be time for a top-to-bottom review, congressionally led, of how this happened. Because there's so many unanswered questions. There's so many things that don't make sense. In particular, why did we surrender Bagram, which is 25 miles north of Kabul, well-defended, far easier to effectuate an evacuation using Bagram than an airport that's in the middle of a city of 5 million. And that's really the task right now. We've already had the Saigon moment. Everyone's seen the images. We can debate just how severe and long-lasting the damage to U.S. credibility and our deterrent posture will be. But now the question in front of all of us is, is it Saigon or Dunkirk? We need to get our people out. We need to muster some energy and creativity to get the, over 10,000 Americans trapped behind enemy lines out and save our Afghan allies, particularly those who risk their lives to fight with us. That's what honor demands at this point. And thus far, I've seen nothing from the Biden administration that would suggest that they can muster up that energy and creativity and that the president himself is willing or capable of leading in this critical moment for U.S. foreign policy. And that's a tragedy. Because this will, in my opinion, have long-lasting consequences. This is just an epic fiasco. But it's not too late to save lives. It may be too late to save face, but it's not too late to save lives right now.
Now, I've seen the estimates range as high as 15,000 Americans. And that, of course, does not include our European allies, any aid workers from even non-aligned countries, plus our Afghan allies, and every woman and girl who's going to be subjected to sexual slavery and discrimination under a ruthless regime. So the question becomes, would you vet people or would you bring them here and vet them here, as we did with the South Vietnamese at Camp Pendleton after the fall of Saigon in 1975?
Well, you could do either. I mean, it just depends on what's available. There was some talk of using Fort McCoy in Wisconsin. I actually called up the base yesterday. They've received no formal order from the Defense Department. So my sense is, even though that's been reported publicly, it hasn't become an official order or a moving operation within the Defense Department right now. I think we need to just get creative, though. I mean, we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. The imperative has to be to get our people and our allies out. Now, that being said, Hugh, I do think we still need to do vetting, regardless of where it physically takes place. I think the American people appropriately have concerns, particularly in light, and I don't mean to conflate these two issues, but the concerns, I think, are exacerbated in light of the terrible situation at the southern border. We just need to give confidence to people that when people are eligible for the SIV program, they're still going to go through vetting, even though we may have to take temporary measures such as housing people at military bases or finding allied countries or places in the region where we can offer people temporary asylum. And I happen to know for a fact, having been on the phone with a variety of people, including those in the philanthropic community that want to do everything possible to get people out, there are countries in the region that are willing to host refugees right now.
Oh, Great Britain announced last night. Great Britain announced that they are throwing their doors open. Congressman Gallagher, my brother-in-law, Marine like you, participated in the resettlement program at Pendleton. Now, God bless Wisconsin, but if we send these poor people to Wisconsin, that's adding, you know, freezing to injury. Pendleton did this before. It's, you know, there's a plan on the shelf somewhere to put up thousands of tents and establish field hospitals and field shower. They did this. It's not that hard.
Yeah, I guess I think it raises the question, Hugh, though, where was the plan for this before? I mean, we knew we had 50,000 people at a minimum eligible for the SIV program. We had to know the number of Americans that were in the country. Why did the Biden administration and the Pentagon not develop some sort of plan for how we were going to take care of these people and get them out? I mean, I've been involved in discussions bipartisan behind the scenes with, you know, my Democratic colleagues like Jason Crow about expanding the SIV program. And I just got to tell you, the Biden administration has been completely asleep at the wheel. Congress has had to push them at every turn. And now we're seeing the consequences of not having a plan play out in real time.
Now, Congressman Gallagher, I have no doubt, none, zero, this would not have happened if President Trump had been reelected. Mike Pompeo would not have allowed it to happen. Robert O'Brien would not have allowed it to happen. People that you know would not have allowed it to happen. We have factual evidence of what President Trump did when confronted with visual evidence of atrocity and collapse. He killed Soleimani. He struck at Assad. We know what he would have done if they broke the agreement. Do you agree or disagree with me?
I agree with that. As much as I disagreed with elements of the Doha deal, and as much as, you know, I wanted us to maintain a small presence in Afghanistan and really articulate, in a way I don't think we did successfully, the value of Bagram over the long term, not just as a counterterrorism base, but as a valuable asset in the long-term competition with China, I do think it is fair to say that Trump particular and his national security team in general, and Trump having a, let's say, unique sense of optics, would have responded as the situation deteriorated, would have at least tried to provide some support to our allies on the ground. I mean, the Coast Protection Force, you know, my informal networks tell me that they were still fighting. They were ready to fight to the death as of 2 days ago. I mean, these are people who have killed more Taliban than anybody else in the world, and yet they were forced to surrender. We now have reports that in Panjshir, that Ahmad Shah Massoud's son is still resisting with a force of hardened fighters. It's not like everybody in the country, you know, surrendered to the Taliban. There are allies on the ground, and there are capable fighters on the ground. So I do believe that the Trump administration would have taken a different tack. And I thought Vice President Pence articulated that well in the Wall Street Journal. And again, came back to that point of, you know, you don't abandon Bagram first if you're trying to effectuate a withdrawal. And as for the value of Bagram over the long term, I mean, it has long runways capable of supporting the heaviest of our bombers, our cargo aircraft. You know, from that location, you could hold Western China and most of China's counter-space activity at risk. And Bagram was an easy location to defend overall. Think of one of the Army's planned long-range hypersonic weapons units being based there. What we could have done with that, the costs we could have imposed on China in terms of a missile defense investment, and how many resources we could have forced them to pull away from their eastern shore if we had that very small but powerful asset on their western flank. This was the type of geostrategic creativity we didn't see.
I agree, but in the immediate future, I have been reading these reports about son of Massoud as well in the valley that you described. Ought the United States, your colleague Michael Waltz in the Nixon seminar has floated the idea of establishing safe zones to which Afghans can flee, one of those being that valley. Ought we to be doing that? Ought we to establish some kind of Underground Railroad out of Afghanistan at various points?
Well, I agree we need to be doing everything possible to get our people out, and it's probably going to require something like that. I mean, with the fact that we are relying upon the largesse and generosity of the Taliban for safe passage to the airport, our single exit point of the country, is an absurd strategy. It's an embarrassment, and I think it's just fraught with peril. Imagine if the Taliban decides not to honor whatever secret deal that Jake Sullivan and Blinken have struck with them, what sort of hostage situation we'll have on our hands? Our entire strategy for getting our people out, American citizens, not even to mention the Afghan allies, rests upon the generosity of the Taliban right now. That's unacceptable from my perspective. We have to be exploring other options in order to protect American citizens. And right now I haven't seen that. And part of the problem, Hugh, is that, you know, we're not in session in Congress right now. We haven't been able to get a classified briefing. I understand there's not much we can do from a legislative perspective, but I do think it would be valuable for the Speaker to reconvene Congress, because we're all getting calls from our constituents as well, who know people that are trapped in Afghanistan. And the process the State Department has in place right now is just not sufficient. It's very confusing. In some cases, we don't know where to send these people. I think we need to be back in session, particularly those, let's say, who are on the Armed Services Committee, the Intelligence Committee, the National Security Committee in Congress. We have to be doing everything possible to get our people out, and it's not happening right now.
Last question, Congressman. Will the American public internalize the toxic combination of incompetence, indifference, and inability manifested by the Biden administration, particularly with the president, when it comes to the Iranian negotiation? Dare they bring forward a JCPOA 2.0 and say, trust us, it will work?
Well, I don't want to underestimate their incompetence after this episode. I do believe there are many in the administration that remain fanatically committed to resurrecting the lifeless corpse of the Iran deal. And again, remember how they sold this Afghanistan fiasco? It was, well, we need to free up resources in order to focus on China. Now we've seen this is the exact opposite is playing out. We're rerouting carriers from the Pacific. We're ultimately going to destabilize India because of the way Pakistan benefits from this, which is the worst thing you do if you care about China over the long term. I can imagine a similar illogic being used to justify getting back into the Iran deal. Well, if we get the Iranians hooked on cash, we'll stabilize the Middle East, we can reduce our posture, and we can focus on the China fight. This will be the sort of ironic and tragic end of the Biden administration's foreign policy and grand strategy, such as it exists. It'll be the exact same mistake that Obama made. And that's really what we're getting here, Q. We're getting a combination of Obama's foreign policy and Bernie Sanders' domestic policy. And that's a bad combination for America. That's a losing combination.
It's going to take a Reagan. It's going to take a Reagan. Mike Gallagher, Congressman extraordinaire from Wisconsin, thank you for joining us. Follow him at Rep. Gallagher. His Twitter feed has been invaluable. ReliefFactor.com is also a sponsor of the Hugh Hewitt Show. And after the show, like I did yesterday, though it is, I don't know, a heat index of 110 in D.C., out I go because I got to work off the tension. It's raining this morning. Not sure if I'm going to go outside in the beltways, highways, and byways. But if I do, it will be pain-free because of ReliefFactor.com. $19.95 gets you started. And if you don't start, you can't get better. You can't feel better. You can't get rid of those minor aches and pains that afflict your daily living, whether it's reaching for the peanut butter or taking a walk. Some of you with dogs, you hate to take the dog out because your knees bark at you more than the dog does. Try ReliefFactor.com. And then come right back, America. I'm joined by Brian Westbury. What exactly does American collapse abroad mean for markets? Westbury joins us next on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Come back, America. When the world needs good, sound economic analysis, it ought to turn to Brian Westbury, chief economist for First Global Trust in Chicago. Brian, of course, teaches as well at Wheaton College, and he and I will be in Atlanta at the Atlanta History Center on October 13th, talk about the Biden inflation. I hope we're not talking about chaos in international markets. But Brian Westbury, what does a collapse of American credibility as complete and catastrophic as what we have seen over the last 96 hours do to the economy of the United States and indeed of the West?
You know, Hugh, this is the last time, at least in our, you know, in our short lifetimes, that we looked like this was the 1970s, and it's kind of weak policy, and with weak policy also comes weak economic policy, and we ended up with inflation. We ended up with slower growth in the economy. We ended up with more unemployment. We ended up with lower growth in standards of living. And the only thing that turned it around was Reagan in the early 1980s, when we invested in defense and became strong again. We raised interest rates and stopped just printing money and handing it out. And when we did that, guess what happened? The economy healed. And so, you know, right now we're, you know, things move faster. This is internet time. It's not like the 70s where it all rolls out over, you know, years and years and years. We live in internet time, it seems, today. And so things are going to happen really fast. I don't know how bad things have to get before America chooses to fix things, but we're in that process right now of finding out all over again.
Now, Brian, I am only optimistic about the American tech sector for the simple reason that the Chinese Communist Party is cracking down on their tech sector. So people who want to invest in technology have to do so in the United States or the European Union. But, I mean, what does an investor do? You can't buy any more houses. They're now priced actually beyond their value, I think. There's gold, there's precious assets, there's collectibles, but what do you do? What are you advising First Trust portfolio clients?
Well, remember, you know, in an inflationary time, I mean, we're oil prices. I mean, we're at $67 a barrel. You know, 15 months ago was $28 a barrel, if I remember correctly, or pretty close to that. Gold prices up to, you know, $1,790. I like hard assets. I like land. Even though house prices have jumped, I think they are permanently higher in price. And the reason they're higher in price is because we've printed more money. You know, some of this is just pure math, right? And that takes out the politics. It takes out the emotion. We've printed 30% more money, and we can get mad about that. We can yell at politicians about that, but in reality, it presents opportunity for people who realize it. Inflation is here, and so, you know, hard assets work. Real estate works. Lands work. Land works. Commodities work. I like energy companies. I think interest rates are going to go up. That means financial stocks will probably do well in the years ahead. And so, you know, there are a lot of opportunities, even though we're taking opportunity away from a lot of people. And that's one of the sad things here, because supposedly we are doing this for equity. And what ends up happening with these policies is we have less equality in the economy. And you can never achieve equity, but doing the things we're doing, the people who focus on building wealth can do it in this environment. People who want to just ride the wave and not work, they're going to fall behind. That's the sad part of all of this.
Last question, Brian Westbury, and I'm looking forward again. People should check our AM970 affiliate in Atlanta if they want to get tickets to our Biden inflation seminar in October. Does the collapse in Kabul and the catastrophe in Afghanistan undermine America's reliability in its treasury market?
Oh, you know, like this, the quick answer would be, I don't think it'll do it quickly. But the long term answer is, yeah, things begin to unravel. I mean, this the whole set of issues that we're facing right now, we have not faced since the 1970s. And so you think about the withdrawal from Vietnam and what happened in Saigon. We closed the gold window under Richard Nixon, which basically was because France was asking for gold. And we said, we're not going to give you gold. You can have these paper dollars. And so what happens is politicians who want to force the world to look like they want it to look, rather than live within the rules of economics, they always cause mayhem like this.
Brian Westbury, you're a wise fellow, and I appreciate your taking the time with the follow on Twitter at Westbury, W-E-S-B-U-R-Y. First Trust Portfolio's chief economist. He's got a great blog over there. Stay tuned on the Salem News Channel and on my iTunes account or on my YouTube account. I'm coming back with Leader Mitch McConnell in Hour 3 of today's Live You Do It show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Inside the Beltway, joining me now live is GOP Senate Leader Mitch McConnell from the state of Kentucky. Senator McConnell, thank you for joining me.
Glad to be with you, Hugh.
You've known President Biden a long time, Leader McConnell. Has he reached out to you since the collapse in Kabul and the catastrophe that followed began 96 hours ago?
No, I haven't heard from him. He's got better things to do than to call me. He needs to figure out how to handle this evacuation. They may have finally secured the airport, Hugh, but we have reports from people all over the country having difficulty getting to the airport, being harassed.
And Clarissa Ward is reporting that that is breaking down as well outside of the airport as we speak. You also, a former colleague with the vice president, has she called you? I mean, you're the leader of half the Senate. You've been there for 40 plus years. I would think that it would be routine for the president and the vice president to reach out to the senior Republican in America.
Well, no, but look, this is bigger than just any of us getting offended because we haven't been called. I mean, what's going on here? This is a colossal mistake. Hugh, I'm somebody who believed that the light touch deployment we had in Afghanistan was actually working. We didn't have a single one of our military personnel killed in combat in the last year. The lid was tightly on. Al-Qaeda was not back in the country. We probably spent more money on this evacuation effort already than we were spending on an annual basis, which, by the way, was about 1% of the defense budget we were spending on this, 1%, to keep the terrorists over there rather than making it easy for them to come over here. I think it was a policy that was actually working.
I was watching you last night, Leader McConnell, with Brett Baer. You said terrorists around the world are cheering. The Taliban has, in effect, defeated the United States of America. Previous presidents wanted to leave Afghanistan, but in the end, they didn't. They kept the lid on. I wouldn't have left. If you were going to leave, have a plan. These guys couldn't have organized a two-car funeral. End of quote. Exactly right. Do you believe Donald Trump would have left this way if he had been reelected?
Well, I certainly would have hoped that President Trump, had he pursued the policy that he indicated he wanted to pursue, would have taken more time to plan it and operated better. I'm sure he could have done better than this. I don't see how this could have been worse than the way it was handled.
I believe that the 2,500 Americans, 5,000 NATO troops and air power from Bagram could have maintained the status quo for as long as necessary to at least remove our military equipment and our Afghan allies. Do you?
Yeah, I think so. There's no question about that. The first thing I wanted to say, Hugh, I said last night, and you quoted me, I think the policy was working. But if we had to get out, I cannot think of a more botched, embarrassing setback for our country than this. I mean, it makes the retreat from Saigon look well organized.
You're right, Mr. Leader. I got to ask about the 15,000 Americans you mentioned stranded in Afghanistan, much less our European allies, non-aligned countries, or Afghan interpreters, but 15,000 Americans. Do we have to consider retaking Kabul in order to get Americans out before not one, but many, multiple hostage crises erupt across the country?
Look, I don't know at this stage. I'm not a military planner, exactly what it would take, but I think it's incumbent on the administration to do everything they can to get Americans and our Afghan allies who worked with us all these years out of there. Exactly what that takes, I leave to the military planners, but they need to get it done.
If the military recommends and the president adopts an Incheon option, would you support it? Would the Republicans support it?
I think we'd have bipartisan support for a plan that might actually work. I noted this morning, Hugh, that the three Democratic chairmen of the Defense, Armed Services, and Intelligence Committees announced they are upset about this as well. So the president has managed to alienate even his allies with this step. And in terms of the political consequences of it, his approval rating below 50% for the first time.
I want to play for you. June of last year, I had former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates on, and I had asked him about his famous quote about President Biden never being right about anything. Right. He stood by it, but he added this last summer. Let's play the Robert Gates quote.
I also think that the vice president had some issues with the military, and I wrote in Duty about how he would warn the president that he was being boxed in, that the military was trying to take away his options and so on, and he'd kind of rail at the generals, and that bothered me some.
Does that bother you as well, Leader McConnell? Has he cut himself off from sound military advice?
Well, he was getting sound military advice. I'm absolutely confident, because I was talking to the military leadership as well, that the decision to withdraw was something they thought was a mistake, and I believe they had said that to the previous president and the one before that. Second, they surely were blindsided by the rapid decision and the announcement of it, and this was just a botched job all the way around, and it, rather than the president Biden pointing the finger at everybody else, he needs to point the finger to himself. It was his decision. He owns it. And it's an embarrassment of gargantuan proportions for our country. Look at all the terrorists around the world. We've got to be cheering. The ones in Syria and Yemen, in Africa, they see the Taliban flag flying over the palace in Kabul. What a disaster.
I foresee Zawahiri, if he is alive, reappearing soon from a studio near you in Afghanistan. But let me ask you, Mr. Leader, we had a 9/11 commission and we needed it. We are not going to have a January 6th commission. Will there be an August 2021 commission on the collapse and catastrophe in Kabul and Afghanistan?
Well, there's certainly going to be plenty of inquiries. As I just said, the three defense and foreign policy-related committees in the Senate under Democratic chairman have already announced that they're beginning a hearing process. We need to find out how this happened and monitor it as we move along and keep the pressure on. This job is not over. This withdrawal is not complete until all the Americans are safely out.
Have you had any explanation on the decision to turn off the lights and the electricity at Bagram weeks ago and decide to conduct this from Kabul Airport in the middle of a city of 5 million as opposed to 20 miles outside of the city in a highly defensible area? Has anyone explained that to you?
Not yet. I've been to Bagram a number of times. That would have been the perfect place to conduct this operation and get these aircraft out safely. Instead, we're in the airport downtown, as you indicated. Probably the worst possible place to conduct the operation.
Congressman Michael Waltz has suggested we may have to set up safe zones in Afghanistan to which Americans and allies can retreat. There are some reports of scattered resistance in pockets. The Son of Massoud is operating online. Will you support American decisions by the president to either establish those areas or support remaining allies in the country?
Well, I'm more than happy to support anything that may conduct a successful rescue mission. That's what we're in the middle of now. And I want the president and the administration to succeed in getting our people out.
There has been significant damage done to our reputation with allies. The European press is full of it. It's not quite gotten here yet. Are there steps that could be taken by the president to, say, reassure Taiwan immediately?
Absolutely. We need to reassure Taiwan. The Chinese have been threatening them more intensely recently, and we can't let that happen. The Chinese have to be emboldened by what they've seen occurring in Afghanistan.
On August 4th, Reuters reported that Biden plans a shift in arms policy to add weight to human rights concerns. Quote, two State Department deputy assistant secretaries will brief congressional staff on Biden's draft conventional arms transfer policy on Friday. Is such a turn away from arming our allies wise, Senator McConnell?
What about the human rights concerns of Afghan women and girls and those who cooperated with us? This is a human rights debacle. The worst thing the administration is doing is trying to reduce the defense budget significantly below inflation for the first time in years. That also sends a message to the Chinese and to the Russians that we are putting our emphasis, shall I say, elsewhere.
A JCPOA is in the offing, a JCPOA 2.0. Will Americans internalize the incompetence and incoherence of this administration and reject as viable any such negotiation, Leader McConnell? And if they still come forward with it, ought it to be submitted constitutionally to the Senate for a two-thirds vote?
Well, that's the way it should have been done the last time. And, of course, the President Trump was correct to pull out of the Iranian nuclear deal negotiated by President Obama. And now you've got basically the same crowd back in power and trying to reconstitute something that didn't work the first time. So I don't think this deal is likely to come together. If it does, it certainly ought to be submitted to the Senate as a treaty.
The United Arab Emirates arms sale was delayed. Saudi Arabia was denied that which they had negotiated under the Trump administration. Should that decision be revisited in light of our collapsing position in Afghanistan?
Absolutely.
You mentioned defense spending, Mr. Leader. Rightly, the federal government spent trillions of dollars in the last year of the Trump administration to deal with COVID. Joe Biden spent $2 trillion that was not necessary at the beginning of this year. Another trillion in infrastructure spending, which I support, has been approved. The House is holding it up on the demand that another $3.5 trillion be spent. None of this has gone to defense spending. It's inexplicable.
Yeah, it's wildly out of proportion to what the country needed. The new administration inherited three vaccines that were working. Really a modern medical miracle to have three vaccines developed in less than a year. The biggest challenge now is to get shots in arms to deal with this resurgent Delta variant. And we don't need to shower the country. You know, Larry Summers was a real hero here. He's probably not on the Christmas card list at the White House any longer.
Huh.
He said back in February about the rescue package that we were going to create inflation by flooding the country with all this money. That's exactly what they did on a party line basis. Not a single Republican in the House or Senate voted for it. We've got raging inflation now, and we're paying people more to stay home than to go back to work. I was just with a bunch of employers in Kentucky yesterday. They can't get people back to work because of the $300 a week bonus, which our Democratic governor refuses to give up. Yeah, I mean, this wild spending spree is going to send the country's economy in the wrong direction. I'm hoping we can defeat the 3.5, which is probably closer to $5 trillion largely tax increase on individuals and businesses and estates. Exactly the wrong thing to do. Before COVID hit, we had the best economy in 50 years in February of 2020, largely because of the 2017 tax bill during the previous administration. They want to undo all of that, and it takes the country absolutely in the wrong direction.
Now, Mr. Leader, I'm concerned that President Biden is clinging to his own personal worldview of weird stuff like getting rid of stepped-up basis, which would be a disaster for millions of Americans, small businessmen, homeowners. I mean, just an absolute disaster. But he's clinging in the face of evidence to that angry speech he gave on Monday. Do you have concerns about his ability to process anything he doesn't already believe?
Well, he has some, you know, I like Joe Biden personally, but he was never a moderate. He was always a liberal, and he called himself a moderate in order to win the nomination, and that worked. But this is not a moderate administration. It's a left-wing administration. Joe was always part of the liberal crowd in the Senate, and they're trying to squeeze all of these liberal policies through a Congress that is very, very narrowly divided. They didn't get a mandate, you, for this. A 50-50 Senate and a couple of seat majority in the House doesn't spell a mandate to me to do all of this.
Oh, they got no mandate to destroy American foreign policy either in our standing in the world. Last question, Mr. Leader. The urgency of returning both houses to GOP control is obvious, but there is a recall in California. What would be the effect of Gavin Newsom being recalled on the Democrats? Would it wake them up?
I don't know. It would sure be a big story, wouldn't it? I mean, that would be an incredible story. It's actually happened once before in California a few years ago, and we're all watching it with a lot of interest.
Would you welcome that result?
Listen, I think Newsom is a good example of ultra-liberalism. If a left-wing state like California took out Newsom, that would be a big, big story.
Leader Mitch McConnell, thank you for joining me, Senator. Good luck in making the rounds. You were absolutely on spot last night and again today, and I appreciate your candor.
Thank you.
I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-1172.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.